This program is brought to you by Stanford on iTunes U at Stanford University. Please visit us at itunes.stanford.edu.
Ladies and gentlemen, we reach now the real crucial section of the material of our course. It's the most controversial material about Yeshua. I think it's needlessly controversial. That is to say, those who make controversy usually don't understand the method for approaching these texts. I'm thinking not just of conservative evangelicals, but even mainstream Catholic, Anglican, Methodist, Presbyterian churches, which were not usually identified as fundamentalist. When it comes to what they call the resurrection, and I'll always use that word in quotes, because we'll find out that that's the wrong word as regards the Greek of the New Testament for what they're trying to talk about. When it comes to the resurrection, people seem to stop reading the Bible, and they use the Bible to support what they hold extra-biblically. They've gotten some notions into their heads from their preachers, from their priests and ministers, and then they use the Bible to support those. What we're trying to learn how to do is to read the Bible and understand what it meant for those who wrote the texts and for the communities that used them, and then see if they have anything at all to say today. This is the most controversial because with the resurrection, Christian believers say they are at the foundation of their faith. If Yeshua isn't resurrected in the way they understand resurrection, then nothing makes any sense. Certainly Christianity, they would say, makes no sense if you're basing it on a dead man. And yet, resurrection is the turning point where finally, at last, Yeshua's message can be lost. It may be the beginning of Christianity, but it runs the risk of being the end of Yeshua. Yeshua preaches the kingdom of God, which is a Jewish first century symbol for God's empowering of people to deal with one another. He doesn't need any attention. They need the attention to deal with one another in radical mercy and justice. That's the kingdom of God. It's non-apocalyptic in his telling. It will soon become apocalyptic, as we'll see again today. But when you take the kingdom of God and substitute for that Jesus of Nazareth, Yeshua, as the message, then you've lost what he was about. The last thing that he was about was himself. Christianity makes the entire message be about him. Yeshua was not trying to do away with the Jewish religion, but he wasn't in favor, as we could see, of any particular religion. He lived his Jewish religion, of course. But his message was about what religion was for, what it was about. It's not an end in itself. It's a means to something else. And yet, if he stands there at the edge of religion to say, here's what it's about, the kingdom of God, if religion is but a means to get to that, what Christians have done is invent a new religion about him, the Jesus religion. That happens with the resurrection. So, imagine if, maybe this category doesn't appeal to many of you, but imagine if an utterly charismatic anarchist, I know that sounds bad, that sounds like bomb throwers, but an anarchist, came into your community and said, I'm here to free you from the oppression of government, I'm here to free you from the oppression of a certain economic system, I'm here to free you from all of those police forces, you know, the way anarchists do, and then you elect him president. That would be somewhat ironic, wouldn't it? That would be somewhat different from what he had in mind. Why make somebody the center of religion when he's really trying to, in a sense, dissolve religion? Yes, keep it, but dissolve it into what it's about. Then the religion has come to fulfillment. So he doesn't come to abolish Torah, he comes to fulfill it. Not do away with it, but say, here's what it's really about. So it was a very Jewish move that he was making, and instead, he has now become the god of a new religion. allegedly the best religion that surpasses all religions, but it's just one more religion, and therefore somewhat off the track. What I'd like to do this evening in the 2 hours that we have is mostly deconstruct, that's another word for analyze, what resurrection meant to the first Christians. That's the primary step in any investigation of history. You first have to break it up into its component parts. That's what the word analyze means. Luein, lies, luein in Greek means to break, and ana means up into its constituent parts. When we lay them out on the table, and this is what we've been doing constantly, when we lay them out on the table, when we find out who wrote them and why, we could begin to get the meanings that those texts had for the first century. Only then can we ask whether they have any meaning at all today, and what might be necessary to change about them in order to have meaning today. So, analytic approach, it's not destructive, but it deconstructs, it unbuilds for a moment, and that will be our task in the perhaps the first hour. And in the second hour, I'd like to begin to present what it positively meant to the apocalyptic communities who first gave us this word. Okay. We're back to our same old problem. How did Yeshua become the Christ, the center of the Christian religion? The question now is, how did Yeshua become resurrected? One way of asking that question, Dominic Crossan does, is how long did it take him to get resurrected? Of course, if you take the story in its literal Mel Gibson sort of way, it took an instant, a flash. Right? Then there were some events that went on after that for perhaps a day, perhaps a week, perhaps 40 days. Right? But Crossan is asking, how long did it take between the death of Yeshua and the general conviction in the first century that resurrection language, we'll find out it's the wrong language, but resurrection language is the best way to interpret his death? What we're trying to do is make a distinction between an interpretation and a historical event. That's utterly crucial here. Think of the bookends, the birth of Yeshua, the resurrection of Yeshua. Well, actually, even before the birth, the conception of Yeshua and the resurrection of Yeshua. Right? They're bookends. They're not events. They're theological stories invented to say what these communities thought the meaning of all the books in between is. They are theological interpretations. The fancy word is theologumena. They're faith interpretations. They're not historical events. But the process of traditional Christianity has been to turn both of those into historical events. What happened in the life of Miriam of Nazareth before she bore her son Yeshua, and what happened to Yeshua himself after he was killed, executed, murdered by crucifixion, by torture. Well, our effort is to try to distinguish between faith and history there. Of course, we all know what resurrection means. Yes, please.
Drew the previous picture of Yeshua. Is that based on?
That's based on the British forensic psychologist, and I think his last, Richard N. I can find out that name. And in fact, if you go on the web where I found that picture, they'll give you the story about it. You know, you kind of look up images of Jesus and you click on that one or somehow find it in Google. Okay. What he did was, I mentioned, is he took a bunch of first century, such as we have, first century Semitic male skulls. And then, as forensic guys do, put the clay on it and the eyebrows and made it as it would have been among a typical male group of the first century. So it's a wild guess.
Not specific to him, it's generic.
Absolutely. So that if we wanted to find, if he were alive or had just died today, we could go around and collect skulls from mortuaries, I guess, and do that same thing, the way police detectives do when they're trying to reconstruct who this person is that died. But now they're trying to do it specifically for one person who was murdered, let's say the police, right? And he did it with a bunch of first century Semitic skulls, so it's a best a guess.
But not a wild guess.
Not too wild, I would guess. I don't know. I always like to play on the hairdo, you know. I mean, but anyway, we all know what the resurrection look like. At least this Mormon holy card, which was given to me at my door, along with the Book of Mormon, about a year ago, they know what it looks like, and I'm very grateful to them for this. There's Yeshua appearing to Miriam of Magdala. We call her Mary Magdalene. Let's just kind of go through what the traditional view from, let us say, a traditional, you know, mainstream Christian pulpit. Certainly in my Catholic tradition, this is what you would see. The resurrection has a date. It took place on the first day of the week. We would call that Sunday. It would be the 16th of Nisan, the month of Nisan, which runs by the lunar calendar in the Hebrew calendar. He was killed on the 14th of Nisan. And so this would be April 9th, 30 CE, an exact date. We don't have the time. Sometime perhaps before dawn, because when they got there at dawn, he was already resurrected. It also has a location. It's located at his tomb where he was buried, presuming he was buried in a tomb. And it's just west of Jerusalem's Chain Gate. Let me see if I can find a couple of maps for you here. They're not terribly clear. I'll show you two maps of Old Jerusalem. Modern Jerusalem is off there to the upper left, if you will. But the walls of Jerusalem, as you can see here, included the temple area, now the area called the Dome of the Rock, right, which would be located right about in there, and the Antonia. Do you see up top there? That was a fortress, a Roman fortress, so they could look down on the temple in case there was any revolutionary activity there. The wall at Yeshua's time stopped where you see the red wall here. Within a few years, they built an outer wall, and maybe even a further wall that was breached by the Romans in 69-70. Here's where he would have been tried, probably. And it would have been a short trip up, out, and to that area there, where there was an execution spot in a quarry called Golgotha, the place of the skull. It's a very short walk. I've paced it off myself, and it takes about, walking normally, I would say 15 minutes. Now, if he was under torture and so on, it would have taken longer, but it's very close into town.
What might have been the population of Jerusalem?
Oh, good question, and there is a book that knows that, and I don't know that right offhand.
Just trying to get it.
It would have been four times its normal population at Passover, but I can't tell you that, and I'm sorry. I think I have it in my book in a footnote, but I'm not sure. Do I?
You do. In your book in a footnote, 25,000 swells to somewhere between 60 and 120. An additional 60 to 125.
25,000 is a small, by our standards, a small town, but it was a major city in the Levant. And those numbers come from Jeremias, I believe, the German scholar now dead, who's done a lot on.
And it swelled to
four times that at Passover. And that's why the Roman soldiers always came in at Passover. They were stationed out at Caesarea Maritima, out on the coast, but they would march up and be present there to make sure that there was no political trouble. And so, if Yeshua is doing something that's getting in trouble with the temple, if they even hear the word king or emperor or Mashiach, you know, which translates as Basileus, which is the Greek name for Caesar, he's dead. You know, it doesn't take much in those very difficult times. Ooh, how many square miles? Now that's a good question. Certainly, you see the Fish Gate, which is the Damascus Gate now. Many of you have walked this. You can walk from there down to here in a half hour, less. That's an easy walk. I mean, that's taking a lot of time because it's so lovely and you're seeing all sorts of things. To walk from here to there, up that main street that I can't remember the name of right now, up to the Jaffa Gate, I think it's the Jaffa Gate, is it? That takes maybe 15 minutes, so it's small, relatively small. Sorry, let's see, maybe in the next slide, no, they don't have here either. No doubt one could find one that has meters or feet. Here's a more colorful map of the same thing. I put the red mark above Golgotha, it should be underneath it. That's where the presumed execution took place. and there are tombs around that. So what happened is in the 4th century, when Constantine legitimized Christianity, stopped the persecutions, if you will, his mother, who was very devout, went off to Palestine to discover the holy places. And what we call the holy places are 4th century guesstimates of where they were. Now, if I were around at that time, and I'm pretty sure this is what happened, every time you heard that the queen was coming into town and she was wondering where Mary might have rested on the way to Bethlehem, my uncle's farm is certainly where she definitely, and they would probably want to buy that and build a church, but it would be a handsome price that we might charge the empress, you know. So we're really not sure, frankly, of where these places are. There's a nice book whose title I can't remember now about the finding of these holy places. So she arrives, and she's looking for the three crosses. Whether there were three is another question, right? At least there was one, we may presume. And so she was asking around, and somebody said, I know where there are three crosses. I'll take you there tomorrow. No doubt that night they did a lot of digging and a lot of burying of woods and so on. And to prove that they were the three crosses, according to legend, a sick person was brought to, of those three crosses, right? One of them was touched, didn't work. Second was touched, didn't work. Third one, bingo, did the trick, cured him. So that had to be Yeshua's cross. You know, not these are probably almost certainly not historical.
Regarding Constantine's devout Christian mother, was she converted before or after Constantine's
conversion? I don't know exactly. And rather than guess,
Catherine is being converted to Christianity.
There's no evidence of that, as far as I know. He didn't convert to Christianity, but he allowed Christianity in December of 312 after he defeated the former emperor Maxentius. He didn't himself convert until his deathbed in 335-ish or so.
Baptized.
Christianity is an official religion. No. He legalized it, so you could be persecuted. By the end of the 4th century, with Theodosius and after that Honorius, it was made the official religion, and synagogues were closed, temples were closed, people were persecuted. So it was the real reversal.
Okay. So do we even know when his mother...
I don't know that. I wish I did, but I don't, and no doubt we can find that out. Helena was her name. Okay, so this gives you, remember what we're really trying to do is say that it has an actual location. You know, whoops, let's see, what's going on here? It has an actual location at the empty tomb, and that's presumed to be the place of the empty tomb. Now, when you make your pilgrimage there, the Anglicans will take you to a tomb that's just above that place up there that says Moat and Antonia. It was a tomb that was discovered in the 19th century. It's a beautiful setting. It's called the Garden Tomb. And it looks like that even if it wasn't the place you wish it were, because it looks exactly like the stories in John's Gospel. It's a beautiful place. It gives you an example of a tomb, but it may not at all be where Yeshua. In any case, what happened is on top of Golgotha, and the presumed tomb of Yeshua, a temple was built, a church, a Roman Catholic church was built, and has been built and superbuilt and destroyed and built again, and that's where you can see. You can actually walk into the tomb of Yeshua of Nazareth, and you'll see a slab there, which is probably a medieval plant, you know, in situ location of something that they claim was where Yeshua died. But inside that church, you will see a little staircase that takes you up to what is a hill that would be Golgotha, if that's where he was crucified, and then just down from that is the tomb. So we got a location for it. Here are the three essentials for the traditional notion of resurrection. An empty tomb. A risen body, clean clothes, and a visible, tangible appearance to someone. Those are the three. But how do they stand up how do they stand up against the evidence when we analyze the text that we have? What I hope to show you is, first of all, how those stories developed by a series of charts. And then to show you how unreflective, non-analytic, Catholic, Protestant preachers turn that history on its head. So how does the resurrection story get invented, harmonized, presented as a package, and preached on, let us say, Easter Sunday morning?
First, just the Protestant teachers turned it on their heads?
No. The Catholics are even worse. Or as bad, let's say as bad. My tradition, so I can shake my finger at it. And it's not just fundamentalists. If you go to virtually, well, many, I can't say all, I don't know, Christian churches on Easter Sunday morning, they'll pretty much presume or preach the story that was represented by those pictures that I just showed you. That particular story of his appearance to Miriam of Magdala, occurs only in John's Gospel. We'll read it in just a moment. It's absolutely stunning as a piece of art. A verbal art, but then of course it's turned into history, and that is the original sin, if you will, of Christianity. Sorry, I keep hitting this thing. Okay, our traditional line again. Here's how the texts get written. The Gospel of Peter's account of the resurrection is not the part of Peter that is arguably early. The arrest, the trial, execution of Yeshua is arguably early, and Crossan makes a strong case for that. The resurrection account in Peter is probably into the second century. It's the Macy Day parade, Thanksgiving Day parade, in Peter, as you can read it at the end of Crossan's book. Two humongous angels, so think of Macy's Thanksgiving Day parade balloons in the good old days when they let them go up and, you know, endanger people's lives. Two big angels, that tall, appear from heaven and go into the tomb. How they fit, I don't know. And they bring out a guy who's even taller than they. His head reaches above the clouds. Obviously, the resurrected Yeshua. And there is a cross that accompanies them, that floats out, and it's the cross that speaks and says that, you know, in effect, he's risen. So we'll leave out Peter's gospel. Paul, as you know, that prior to this date here, Paul simply gives telegraphic statements, but no story follows underneath the headline. Yeshua has been awakened. He has been revealed by God to certain people, period.
That's all that Paul says.
We'll talk about that in a second. By the time you get up to the Gospels, that story isn't, that it's not even a story, right? It's a proclamation. That's not good enough. Now you get Easter morning stories. So let's have a look at, remember our three criteria now, how they stack up. Q and Thomas, zero. They never even mention anything like the R word or the Greek equivalent of the R word or an Aramaic equivalent of the R word. There is nothing about. Again, whenever I use resurrection, instead of waving my fingers in the air, I put quotes around it for reasons I'll tell you in a moment. Now, isn't that stunning?
It is.
That the earliest followers of Yeshua in the north, they certainly knew what happened to him when he went down to Jerusalem. They no doubt wished he hadn't. But they knew nothing, or at least record nothing, about what Christianity claims is the foundation of the Christian faith. Paul, a Jewish missionary who remained Jewish till the day he died, he belonged to a sect within Judaism that we would call Messianic Judaism, which identified Yeshua as the Messiah, but as a Jewish Messiah. Paul, who writes letters between the years 50 and 60, 50 and 58 actually, he dies around 62, doesn't mention an empty tomb, mentions no physical body of Yeshua, and no visible, audible, tangible appearances. So here is one of the people who's considered to be, at least as a scribe and a writer and a founder of community, the foundation, theological foundation of Christianity, and he mentions none of those three things. If you look at 1 Corinthians chapter 15, misused by most priests, ministers, and evangelicals, you'll find out that he says that Yeshua died and was buried. Was buried doesn't mean we know where his tomb is. It means he really was dead. Paul doesn't know if he was thrown into a lime pit, the way criminals' bodies would have been, or whether he was hastily buried or not buried at all or left out for animals, which would have been normal, except that it was Passover and it would have been an insult to Jewish traditions. But he mentions no empty tomb. He simply says, and on the third day, that doesn't mean Friday, Saturday, Sunday, third day, as the prophet Osi points out, means the day of direst need. You're really dead on the third day. They kept vigil outside of tombs. So that when in John's Gospel, Yeshua wants to prove that he's God, that's what John's Gospel is about, he waits till his friend Lazarus is dead for 4 days and brings him back. So he can do it when they're even 4 days dead. And as the sister of Lazarus said, don't go near that tomb, he stinks. They actually say that in the Greek. No physical body. He says on the third day he was awakened from the dead, according to the scriptures. Not like we saw it. The only scriptures we have are the ones that says that God will wake up martyrs. But he didn't wait 3 days, three chronological days. He just meant at his death, I, Paul, heard and believe that he was seated at the right hand of the Father. At his death, not 3 days later. No empty tomb. What about the body? He never mentions the body of Christ as resurrected or risen. He does talk about what's going to happen to grandma and grandpa on the last day, the apocalyptic day, when they will be awakened. He says, don't ask me what kind of body they're going to get. And the word that he uses for body is soma in Greek, S-O-M-A. Soma means not just the meat on me, minus my mind. That's a Greek distinction, mind and meat, body and soul, if you will. No, soma in Greek means the entire person, all of you, your personality, your world, as it were, everything that matters to you. So when he describes how grandma and grandpa are going to look, he says, I don't know what they're going to look like. All I know is that their whole person, to soma auton, will be filled with God's life. God's life in Greek is pneuma, like pneumatic, air, breath, life. They will be filled with God's life. God's spirit is the translation usually. But whether they'll have freckles, pimples, come back as the age of 20, as Grandpa would love to do, or come back at the age of 80 when he died, we don't know. Is that not? He has nothing to say about that. He knows nothing about the physics of the awakening body any more than he knows about the physics of Yeshua's awakened body. He never saw it. It went right to heaven, the whole person of Yeshua, in this view. And no visible appearances. Could I just finish this part? No visible appearances. The account in 1 Corinthians 15, written in the mid-50s, in which Paul says, I'm passing on to you what they told me. I believe it, you learned it, you believed it. So let me repeat it. When he gets down to what are usually called visible appearances, he uses the Greek word ophthe, O-P-H-T-H-E. The O is long and the E is long, ophthe. And that means simply, was made manifest, understood, by God. Ophthe means was revealed. Yeshua was ophthed, I'll invent that English word, ophthed, made manifest, revealed by God to, first of all, Simon, Peter, the rock, he's the founder of the church, James, his brother, then all of the disciples, then all of the apostles, then 500 brethren he was made manifest to at one time. Some of them are still alive. And finally, as to someone who was born altogether too late, he was made manifest even to me. That's all he says, made manifest. That word ophthe appears in the Septuagint Hebrew scriptures, that is to say the Greek translation of the Hebrew scriptures, which the Christians always use. It appears when Abraham, then called Abram, gets his revelation from God. Pick up out of Ur, go to Haran, and then from Haran into Palestine. Right? It says that God ophthe, God was made manifest to him. But it happened in a dream. So, when Paul uses the word ophthe, he means some kind of manifestation. He doesn't insist that he walked through a door, could be seen with the eyes, could be touched. That'll happen by the end of the century in spades. Secondly, The text I've been talking about here is 1 Corinthians chapter 15. Another epistle of Paul's, the epistle to the Galatians chapter 1, contains the one and only autobiographical account written by the person to whom it happened of an appearance of Yeshua. We don't have Mary Magdalene's diaries about what happened. We don't have Simon's diaries reporting what happened. Paul is the only one. He received a manifestation of Yeshua from God as at God's right hand. He mentions twice in the first chapter of Galatians that revelation. He uses the same word. The word is apokalypsis, apocalypse, revelation. The second time he uses that word, describing autobiographically, minimalistically, what he got was, he said, God apokalypsai enamoi. God revealed it, disclosed it in me. Not in front of me, not in front of my eyes, but enamoi, in me, not to me, as if in my face. So there is in Paul, be it in 1 Corinthians or in Galatians, absolutely no indication that there were visible, tangible, audible appearances of Yeshua. Later on, Luke, towards the end of the first century, will write, after his gospel, the Acts of the Apostles, what the early church was about. And in that text, which follows right after the Gospel of John in your Bible, in that text, he will give three different accounts of Paul's conversion on the road to Damascus. It's not actually his conversion. He struck outside of the walls of Damascus and then converted inside the walls of Damascus. But outside the walls of Damascus, it's a story invented by Luke, and it's such a good story, he tells it three different ways and they can't be reconciled, right? And there Paul is struck blind and yet hears Yeshua. That would be a manifestation, presumably. It could be with your ears, not your eyes. Right? But it probably never happened at all. Apokalypsai enamoi. He made it manifest to me. I think he made it manifest to him, well, I'll tell you in a moment, when he was spying on the Jewish community of Damascus and was so overwhelmed by the way they lived that he saw there the kingdom of God lived, the Messianic kingdom, and that, I think, is the basis of his conversion.
The word ophthe, I don't pronounce it right.
Ophthe, yes.
That's also the root word for ophthalmology.
Yes, it all comes from, it's a word for to see, and it has three different roots in Greek. The principal parts draw on three different words, horao, the other one is optomai, from which comes ophthalmologist. It also draws on the word edo, the Indo-European root edo, or wido, which is the origin of wisdom. It's also the origin of seeing. Wisdom is really seeing what's going on. So the see there doesn't mean, you know, visual, ocular. It can. You can say, I see you now. But it can also mean, in Greek, oh, I see. I get it.
Right? Now, when we hear about people describing visions, that seems to me the sort of thing that...
And visions can take place in many ways. I mean, in the Bible, visions always take place in sleep, in ecstasy. As Paul once says, whether in the body or out of the body, I don't know, when he's describing another apocalyptic experience that he had after his conversion. So who can say, you know? And as we'll see, it's highly unlikely that any of the stories recounting the dramatic appearances, you know, that you could film, as it were, of Yeshua to the disciples has any historical basis at all.
I'm afraid you lost me a little bit.
All right.
I thought I heard you say initially that Paul had a no for all three of these.
He does.
Okay. But then you went on and you kind of said manifest, the right hand of God. Now, maybe I'm parsing words here, but it does seem to me that that says manifest means he saw a vision, he saw it in some way, and he saw it in, or at least imagined it, in the right hand of God. That sounds to me, well, if it isn't resurrection in the literal sense, it's a miracle. It's certainly something that you normally don't think of, as you described originally. The man is dead. That's the end of it. You certainly saw something of a miracle.
Let's work on that. First of all, what I'm stressing here is not the kind of appearance that's recounted in the later Gospels. Visible, tangible, you know. When they don't believe that he's really there, in Luke's Gospel he says, okay, dead men don't eat. You got anything to eat? In other words, I'll prove it to you. And so he eats something, some fish, which of course raises problems about digestion and resurrected digested food, right? Because he has metabolized that. But we won't go into that. Luke doesn't go into that. It's just a way of saying, I really think he's not dead, dead, dead. Right? So I'm contrasting Paul's ophthe, manifestation, revelation, apocalypsis, with those visible, tangible things. There's none of those in Paul. Now let's go to the good point that you make. He had some sort of experience.
Exactly.
We have an autobiographical account. I had an experience. Now, experiences are not self-interpreting. Something happens to me, and I say, well, wait a minute, that was a psychological, that's probably my mother. No, not say. Then I give another interpretation. And one interpretation I could give of that shock and awe experience that I had is, oh, that was God revealing something to me. The same brainwave showed up on the brainwave recorder, right? But the interpretation of what went on in those brainwave moments can be religious, apocalyptic, psychological, dismissing, etc. Paul Gives had some experience. I'll tell you in a moment what I think that experience was when we look at another map. And he interpreted that experience as a revelation from God. A friend of mine just suffered a massive heart attack, a professor at Stanford. I mean massive. Young man, young by my standards at least, 53 years old, and was perhaps some minutes with no pulse, no brainwave, because when the resuscitators came, he was out. They had used the defibrillating plates on him, and they brought him back. And he wasn't going to, you know, be very healthy afterwards. The guy's now in Los Angeles. He's been walking around the last week or so, and he had this attack only about 3 weeks ago. His mother came from Italy, very sophisticated woman, and she said to me, that's a miracle. I think at Stanford Hospital, they say, that's really great stuff. You know, we got there on time, we got the defibrillators thing. They have an interpretation that's based on medicine. She has an interpretation that's based on religion. She meant not miraculous, it was really extraordinary. She meant, she told me, I prayed and God answered my prayers. What I'm saying is, experiences have many interpretations. Paul had an experience, no question about that. The language that he used was not the language of Luke or Mark or Matthew and John, namely visible, physical, etc. He uses, as you correctly said, religious language to say, I saw something. The content of that is, again, he didn't look up into heaven and see a throne and there's Jesus. No, that was his interpretation from his Jewish experience of he is with God. God is empowering him. God is giving him all of his power, making him the Messiah, seated at the right hand. He never saw that with his eyes. That was his interpretation of whatever that experience was.
All we've been hearing, I mean, and this is what's bothering me a little bit, we are basing what we think about on the language of the present gospel, on the present language of Paul in the New Testament. Now, at some time in the past, each of those people wrote some words on a piece of paper.
Papyrus.
2,000 years ago almost. And those words have been copied in many languages, repeated, and so forth. My question is this. Since our whole thought process in this course depends upon our present interpretation of the words as we see them now, how comfortable are you with the provenance of these words as compared to the words as originally written 2,000 years ago?
The short answer is I'm as confident about those words as I am about the words of secular historians who wrote about Caesar Augustus, for example, Suetonius, Tacitus, and et al. In other words, we had the same problem with those secular texts as we have with these religious texts. The copies we have are late. You know? So we might want to say, no, this is the best we can really be absolutely sure is that the earliest accounts of Yeshua date to the 4th century or 5th century, when we have those texts. But that would also mean we'd have to say we know nothing about Caesar Augustus. We know nothing about the destruction of the Temple of Jerusalem by Josephus. All of those ancient historians, with all of those texts, we've got the same problem. So again, the gold standard, the high standard of historians who deal with the secular history is good probability, high probability. That's the same standard applied here. Now, I don't think I'm in a position, I'm not a professional historian, to say which is better. But we have better earlier texts, probably because it's the Christians who preserved them, of the religious tradition than we do of the secular historical tradition. So it's a way of answering and not being able to answer, but answering comparatively with...
I really wanted to know subjectively how you feel about it. This is your field, and you feel that you are really reading the words that they were really originally written. Are you comfortable with that?
I am. I'm comfortable because I'm not, subjectively, I don't locate my commitments on that kind of language going back. I don't have to be sure about that language. I make up my own mind subjectively in terms of what I know about human beings and myself now. And I draw upon the tradition, secular, Eastern, Western, as we all do, as we can. Yeah. If I were someone who said, the Bible is inerrant, literally true, etc., and my life depends on that scripture, those written words, you'd be in deep trouble because we don't have a Bible for lots of years after the death of Yeshua, right? We had various texts running hither and thither, but we didn't have anything like a unified Bible. But myself, I believe more in the historical tradition that gives me a sense of what a human being is like and is about. I don't think that would satisfy most religious people. That would sound too humanistic. But you ask me for my subjective, and we've only got two classes, so I can... Exactly. A couple more questions here. Yes, ma'am.
You know, the Pew Gospel,
yes.
It's a lost gospel, and it's only been reconstructed.
Reconstructed from Matthew, Luke.
I mean, how do we know there's no mention? Just from the reconstruction?
From the reconstruction, exactly.
So just what we have reconstructed, there has been no common passages for us to...
Exactly. Just as there is in Thomas, where we have the complete gospel, in Coptic, there is no mention of resurrection.
So we're assuming kind of that the Q gospel has no mention of it.
That's right.
How do they date Thomas and Q as being 450 earlier than Paul's writings?
Let's just deal with Q now, because that one we've been talking about a lot. Q is dated that early because it's presumed that it took at least 10 years for Q written to show up in any gospel sources. Right? So if it first appears, as it were, in Mark and in Matthew and Luke in the 80s, yeah, it's going to have to be before 70. Paul has no awareness of it, but that doesn't mean that it wasn't contemporaneous with Paul. It probably was contemporaneous. It doesn't necessarily stop there. I'm just indicating the area when it would have been composed. It was probably translated into Greek sometime around 50 or after 50 and picked up by Matthew and Luke thereafter, their communities, and finally recorded by whoever Matthew and Luke were by the 80s.
That's kind of speculative. I mean,
yes, it is.
Mark is written around 70, and now you're saying Q is 20 years at least before Mark, but Mark doesn't know about it.
Mark's in Rome.
Okay. And the final question I have is...
Matthew's in Palestine, and Luke is probably in Syria. So
many different versions of Christ. I mean, in Thomas and Q and Mark and, you know, and
right,
Synoptics and John. Doesn't this all make a strong argument that there really was such a person as Jesus? Because you've got many different versions, but clearly referring to, you know, the same man somehow.
Absolutely.
And if someone had just made up Jesus...
No, as a person,
point,
no.
You wouldn't have all these different versions of a made-up person.
That's a good argument. I think that's true. And And you can still, nonetheless, for $5 in the back of the New Republic or the Nation, find the article that'll prove he did, you know, the book that'll prove he didn't exist. Let me just finish this here because we're approaching 8 o'clock. Let me just kind of go through the next steps here. These questions are important, and please do continue to, oops, that's not right. Oh, yes. The reason why I put that there is to say, look, Paul could have simply, here he is talking to Peter someplace over here, when he visits Jerusalem soon after his conversion, he could have just walked out there if he wanted, you know, it's no big deal. But he knew nothing of it. Presumably Peter knew nothing of an empty tomb. That's what an empty tomb looks like. This I took with my Kodak Instamatic in northern Jerusalem. It's not the Garden Tomb and it's not Yeshua's tomb. It is a late first century tomb, but it gives you some sense of how massive they were. They're sort of semi-underground. And notice, this is a tomb that's open. Do you see the rounded part of this stone? Wow. Imagine three women, setting off on the first day of the week with spices and herbs to anoint the body of Yeshua. And just as they're walking out, just getting into the area, they're saying, oh my goodness, we forgot. Of course, there's a big stone in front of it. And we forgot to ask our husbands, brothers, uncles to come and do what you need to do. You need to get a big lever. I mean, that thick, right? And you stick it. You take two or three men, and then you roll the thing from here over to there. I don't think you'd go to a tomb and forget that.
No,
it's usually a family or right. And then inside there are, they have slots like that, like catacombs. Then they would often, after the bodies had decomposed, take them down and either bury them there or elsewhere, or put the bones cleaned up in an ossuary, a bone box. So there's the stone rolled to the side. Imagine them forgetting. Here again, I keep touching something there. There it is seen from the upper left, right? So I went up and stood where the point of that arrow is and took this photograph, and you can see how massive that stone is. Imagine just sort of, oh, I forgot. And there's the entrance. In any case, it's Mark's genius to have invented the story of the empty tomb. But the three women go, as we'll see in the second half of the hour or later tonight when you go home, you can read those texts. They go out there and they meet, right out of central casting, an angel. Actually, it's just called a man. But we all know it's an angel because his job is to announce the apocalypsis, the revelation. Paul said it was given to him directly in me, he says. Now we've got a story where an angel says it out loud to three women. Why are you looking for the living among the dead? He's not here. See the place where they raised him. He has been awakened. Go to Galilee. He's already at God's right hand. Go to Galilee. That's code for go back to what he was about. There you will see him. There's never an appearance because the women, scared out of their wits, run out of the tomb and say nothing to anyone. Period. End of gospel. That's why Mark's gospel is never preached on Easter Sunday morning, because it's got an empty tomb, but no body in evidence, and no appearances, visible, tangible, no. The angel has made the appearance, as it were. He's made the message clear. And they didn't accept it. Finally, by the end of the century, they get it right. Now we're up to 85. We're at the Jewish gospel of Matthew, and the Gentile Gospel of Luke, focused on the Gentiles, and the unique Gospel of John. There you have empty tomb, very physical body, can be touched. In John, if you don't believe it, go ahead, put your finger right here into these wounds, presumably in his wrist. So he bears still the wounds of crucifixion. We've got a tangible body, a body that can eat. In John's gospel, a body that can give people fishing lessons. Throw the net over the other side, dummies. They do, and they haul in fish, a symbol for gathering converts, if you will. Right? And then he cooks them breakfast. He's also a chef. So we've got a very tangible, physical, risen body, and the appearances are many. And then they just end. Luke is the only guy who gets him off the planet. He's the only one who has an ascension. All the others just sort of end, who knows where he went. All of that. And the text that you have before you, which I invite you to try to harmonize into a biography, a calendar of Yeshua's events, it cannot be done, of course, and for good reason, would give us the sense that resurrection, we'll again get to that word after we get back here, resurrection is an interpretation, beautifully orchestrated, not necessary for Paul, but orchestrated theological faith interpretation, not a historical event. Let's pause at this moment, because it's already five after, and come back with our questions and with more of this stuff here, and see if we can begin to reconstruct why they did what they did. If we continue here a little bit, I think we'll see that the apocalyptic framework made resurrection a no-brainer. It was, you know, again, within quotes. So let's continue here if we may, because there's, you know, just this tonight's class and next week's class and so much to say here. So we analyzed how the stories seem to have evolved, where they don't appear and where they finally do appear. So it's a good 50 years after his death that we get the first appearance of Yeshua. It's 40 years after his death that we get the first empty tomb. Okay. But by the end of the century, the 90s, John creates what I think is one of the most beautiful accounts of a religious meeting. It's mistranslated in the text that you have. Should we look at that for a moment? John's Gospel, chapter 20. It would be the second to last sheet, I believe. The appearance to Miriam of Magdala. Peter and John have raced out to the tomb, and of course there's politics built into the Gospels. John's Gospel is about the beloved disciple. He's the boss. And Peter's kind of a nuisance. By the time of chapter 1, there will be some reconciliation, but there are really community politics going on there. So that you'll notice that in the paragraph just before that, Peter looks in, but the beloved disciple looks in and believes. That's the difference. But now we're down to Miriam of Magdala. Meanwhile, Mary, who had brought them there running to the tomb, stayed outside near the tomb, weeping. Then, still weeping, she stooped to look inside and saw two angels in white sitting where the body of Jesus had been, one at the head, the other at the feet, just like the two cherubim at the Ark of the Covenant, right? One on either side. They said, "Woman, why are you weeping?" "They have taken my Lord away," she replied, "and I don't know where they have put him." She's right at the mouth of the tomb, at the entrance to the tomb. We've seen a picture of that. As she said this, she turned around. That's the key word. Epistrepsis in Greek means epi, around, strepsis, turn. And it's also the word in English for conversion. You turn around. And she saw Jesus standing there, though she did not recognize him. Remember, inside, the cloths were rolled up. Remember, we talked about this problem. I mean, Jesus would be, let us say, in the buff. He would be naked. But no, the Mormon holy card convinces me that he was wearing a white robe. Or maybe it was overalls, because she thinks he's the gardener. And Jesus says, "Woman," same question, "why are you weeping? Who are you looking for?" Chapter 1 of John's Gospel, Jesus turns to the disciples and says, "What are you looking for?" Ti zetete. Here it's ti na zetes. Which person? It's a personal encounter. Whom are you seeking? "Sir," thinking he was the gardener, "Sir, if you have taken him away, tell me where you have put him, and I will go and remove him." Now here comes the mistranslation in this thing. Jesus said, "Miriam," She turned, not knew him, but turned, and said to him in Hebrew, Rabuni. So there's two turns. Can I act it out for you here? Physically, there are two turns, but it's really a spiritual message. She's looking into the tomb, and she turns and sees the man. Who are you looking for? Where have you put him? Miriam. She turns again. No, that isn't what it means. It means she had the insight. She turned her mind around. Right? They put a footnote here, which I didn't copy for you, that the Greek word is, again, epistrepsis, is the noun. She turned, she converted, and she knew him. Rabuni, which means master or teacher. Jesus said to her, do not cling to me, because I have not yet ascended to the Father, but go and find the brothers and tell them, I am ascending to my Father and to your Father, to my God and your God. Notice that there's no ascension mentioned in John's Gospel. It's not necessary. Right? Yeshua is already at, in the faith of the believers, he's already at the right hand of the Father, and these appearances are made up brilliantly. I think this is absolutely stunning. But now I'm trying to point out to you how it gets misused in the fabrication of an Easter story.
So what is the interpretation of why does she not recognize him?
Well, all of the gospel stories say that he shows up and they don't get it.
Okay.
In Luke's gospel, brilliantly, when he's walking along for hours with two disciples, presumably a man and a woman, on their way to Emmaus, they invite him in to dinner. At the dinner, he takes bread and breaks it. And they knew him in the breaking of the bread, which is another brilliant thing. It's in the community that breaks, shares, distributes food that they know him. So there's always that point about you don't believe, so do this, give me something to eat, etc.
Are they saying that even though he died, his message is still here? Is that basically what they're trying to say, like when they turn their minds?
Yeah.
Mark's gospel actually says that. Go back to Galilee. There you will see him. See in the sense of live the life of the Galilee community, you know, in that radical instantiation of the kingdom of God. There you will see him. Luke says they knew him in the breaking of the bread, you know. Other people are denser and they have to put fingers into wounds, you know. And the reason why John has Thomas put fingers in the wounds. Thomas is the most hard-headed and unbelieving of them because of the Gospel of Thomas. The community of Thomas was at rivalry with the community of John. They were close. They're both quasi-Gnostic, but not quite. And so, of course, he blames Thomas. You know, he gives Thomas a bad rap by saying he didn't believe enough. He had to put his... So all of these appearances are for purposes other than what we think they're for, you know, historical events that we could chronologize. But you take a brilliant story like that, then you illegitimately read it back into Matthew and Luke. It's not to be found there. They have other stories. But then you gather those three stories together and you read it back into Mark, which is really hard to do because Mark, if you look at the first page that I gave you, ends with the women leaving the tomb in fear and saying nothing to anybody. Later on, someone said that won't work. So they wrote a second ending to Mark's gospel, which you can read there, Mark's second ending, which has all of the appearances in them, thereby ruining Mark's theology, which was, don't go looking for Yeshua, live the life, which will get you crucified probably, right? His whole gospel is about persecution because he's in Rome and his community has suffered under Nero. Then you take Matthew, Mark, and Luke. I tried to put all the colors together there. Let's see if I can do this. And then you read that back into Paul. Paul had only headlines. So what you do is you write the story for Paul. What he really meant when he said he was buried is that there was an empty tomb. It was vacated. And what he really meant by the word was made manifest or was revealed in me was all of these appearance of things. He just didn't, you know, get around to saying it. He didn't have time. He was in a hurry. So he wrote telegrams rather than stories. And then you declare that those brilliant invented stories were what actually happened 3 days after Yeshua's death. That's the illegitimacy of it all, and the stupidity, frankly, of it all. to take these invented stories, which have faith purposes, theological purposes, and trivializing them into historical events, thereby giving the village atheist all the ammunition she needs, or he needs, right, to say, God, is that ever stupid? And it is, frankly, stupid. And the fact that it's performed by people with doctorates, or people who have at least the authority to preach from pulpits, doesn't make it any less ignorant. If you went to a doctor and she didn't know about the latest treatments for cancer, you'd probably find another doctor. And if she treated you with 10 years ago information about cancer, you would sue her for malpractice, or him. But preachers get a pass, even though they're dealing with issues that concern the existential commitments of people's lives. Does my life have meaning? Will I end up in Gehenna, in hell, if I do this, that, or the other? Right? Even though they advise on those based upon their alleged knowledge of Scripture, they get away with it instead of being, well, let's not sue them. Let's just give them a free pass to the next version of this course. Okay, so you can see how over the years these things change. Now, each one of those texts represents a community. Over here, I put communities. Purple is Paul, right? But all of the communities that fed Paul and that he created. So let's look at where those communities were. In Palestine in the first century, there's a division of the land, of course, into Judea, the real center of the country, Samaria, which doesn't really count, they're only second best Jews, if at all, and Galilee, where they're kind of a little bit weird and they're peasants and they're involved with Gentiles and it's just not pure enough. That's why the Pharisees are up there trying to work with those people in good faith, right? The non-apocalyptic Q community, the non-apocalyptic T, Thomas community, are northern communities by all scholars. But remember, the South is apocalypse land. It began with John the Baptist and others who were mentioned by Josephus, who were apocalyptic preachers. The end is near. Get ready for crash and burn. John's different because he says the crash and burn is going to affect us Jews as well as them Gentiles. So let's all get on board here, Jew and Gentile, and let us undergo the preparatory bath that gets you ready for the final coming. So, in the arena of apocalypse, the Essenes further south by the Dead Sea, the Baptists who are still hanging around Jerusalem, and the communities who take Yeshua's message seriously are almost inevitably going to cast it in not the non-apocalyptic framework, live the kingdom now, but the apocalyptic framework, which was a very thick and, let us say, heavy framework for interpreting it. It's from those apocalyptic communities that other Jewish messianic communities will be founded outside of Palestine, in Damascus, for example, and later on in Antioch and other places like that. Let's go back one. There is a Pharisee zealot probably studying in Jerusalem around the time of Yeshua's death and the communities that form after him. He's a Pharisee of the Pharisees, he said. That is to say, he is the most Pharisee of all. And that is not, please, and we have to be very clear on that. The word Pharisee has taken on in the mouths of Christians a derogatory meaning. It means a hypocrite, a formalist, etc. Thank you for Matthew's gospel, which brought that about. Pharisees were excellent Jewish observers who were trying to make the difficult law of clean and unclean, ritual purity and impurity, accessible even to people up in Galilee and other places, right? To try to help them to live Torah observance well. Paul was his name, or Saul. He had both names. His name didn't change when he was converted. He had a Greek, a Hebrew name, Saul, and then a Greek-sounding Paul. It wasn't a change of name at his baptism. He is persecuting, not in the sense of killing, but he is hounding those fellow Jews who are violating the Torah laws of clean unclean. So he goes to Damascus, probably had already worked in Jerusalem, trying to convince these people that they are violating Torah twice over. First of all, by worshiping or respecting someone who is ritually unclean as their Messiah. It's not Yeshua's fault, but read Deuteronomy. Anybody who's been tortured and left naked and crucified is ritually unclean. We can't help it. That was one of the reasons why the Romans did it. It was a degradation, not just of your mind, your body, it was a degradation of your religion as well. You cannot be touched, you can just be buried as an unclean criminal. So there's their first offense. But outside of Palestine, maybe also in Jerusalem itself, as Acts of the Apostles indicates, these people, Jews to the core, read Isaiah, in which it says the messianic times will mean that the Jewish people will be a light to the Gentiles. In Latin, which is often used in the Catholic Church, lumen gentium, right? The light for the goyim. So they're now acting out the messianic kingdom and admitting uncircumcised Gentiles to their table fellowship. They're doing it in Jerusalem, and they are being hounded out of the synagogues, and they're doing it in Damascus. Paul goes to Damascus. He's not a killer. He's not going to kill these people, but he's going to first try to convince them, and secondly, make sure that they get thrown out of the synagogues if they are violating Torah. As well, they should be thrown out. And he doesn't go charging into the synagogue saying, "All right, who's the..." No. He goes in as a faithful Jew, and he sits, and he watches, and he finds out who these other people are that have their own house meetings with Gentiles. Let's say he goes to that meeting. He goes knowing that these Jews are trashing their religion. They are sitting down with trash. Gentiles, we can't help it. We must separate from them. If we intermarry with them, then we'll adopt their sexual practices, their eating practices. We just like to keep it separate. That's the Pharisaic thing, right? Keep the sacred for God, the profane, let that be elsewhere. And he comes here fully expecting to be disgusted. And instead he sees people breaking bread with one another, sharing with the needy, Gentile and Jew, respecting moral laws, sharing their wealth. I think that's the conversion moment of Paul, not knocked to the ground by a light and hearing voices, stories that Luke makes up, but a much more dramatic conversion. It's like Yeshua calling Miriam by her name, right? It's Paul having the sense that in the messianic kingdom, what we used to call trash is actually God's chosen ones. They with us. That's why he'll say later in Galatians, there is no more distinction between goyim and Jew, between woman, man, between slave and rich man. And we could add gay, straight, left, right, Democrat, Republican. Right? Because you are all one in the messianic blessing of the new kingdom. I'm sorry.
That becomes the kingdom of God on earth.
That's what he sees happening.
The communion you referred to earlier in our lecture tonight, that was what affected Paul, but you didn't define why.
And I think that that's the reason why. Now I'm filling out that hypothesis, and it is a hypothesis.
Can you explain why this is not circumcision? What makes that? Why does that make sense?
Think of the divide of sacred profane, which every religion believes in, right? There's sacred buildings, sacred moments, right? And there are secular buildings and secular moments. We try to keep those separate. And Islam, Judaism, Catholicism, all sorts of religions have this distinction. In Judaism, one of the dividing lines, we saw in the parables, unleavened bread is for God, leavened bread is for home. There's nothing wrong with leavened bread, just don't bring it into church. We would say certain types of dress are fine at the disco. Don't come to church dressed like that on Sunday. That would be this kind of separation. That includes food laws, which go way back in Jewish tradition. Who knows why you can't eat shellfish or why you can't eat, certain kinds of meats, et cetera, et cetera. But that's part of the tradition. We abide by that. And goyim, Jew, is almost necessary given the fact that they've been oppressed by the goyim for the last 600 years, and they have this problem of people slipping away from their tradition and adopting pagan practices, Hellenistic practices, sexual practices, right? Paul is very strict about those, even when he's the Messianic Jew who has believed in Yeshua as Messiah. Well, in traditional Judaism, you don't sit and eat with Gentiles. They're uncircumcised. Circumcision is the way that males distinguish themselves as under God's law, because God commanded that of Abraham, right, that they be circumcised. So when they start to mix the kinds here, right, then you were in deep trouble. And Paul goes there and sees, I imagine, that nonetheless, that wasn't the point. We can all be God's anointed ones, Jew and Gentile alike, which in a sense John had already intimated the Baptist, right, when he said, just because you're of the seed of Abraham doesn't count at all. It's that change of heart that matters. Here they are living this, and they lived a radical, as far as we can tell, actually the apostles has it no doubt idealized. They shared everything. If you're in need, you get mine, you know, because they felt the end was coming soon, you know. They didn't have to worry about mortgages and things like that. To me, that's a much more, a hypothesis of how Paul comes to. If you read Acts of the Apostles around chapter 12 or 13, I forget which, even Peter, who represented the conservative Jewish Christian side, Jewish Messianic side, who didn't want to eat with Gentiles, has a vision. He's up on top of his house and he has a dream. He's hungry and he has a dream of food. Down from the heavens comes a sheet, and in it are all sorts of animals, clean and unclean. And the voice from the heavens says, eat. He says, I've never eaten anything that's unclean. The Greek word is koinon, mere common stuff. I won't touch it. And the voice from heaven says, what God has declared clean, don't you dare declare unclean. Which is the Christian message. I mean, there was such a vision, we don't know, right? But it's the message of those communities that Judaism as light to the Gentiles has made us all clean if we live the kingdom. Okay, so that got us Paul to Damascus, where, did I have my clicker here? Yeah. What about the other communities? Again, apocalyptically based. Paul's communities include Antioch, beautiful city that is well worth the visit today in Syria. Whoops.
Isn't that in Turkey?
It is.
Is it Turkey and Nexus, 1930?
Let's go to... The Antioch is still in Syria. Turkey annexed an area just north of Antioch, and it's still contentious. What is the framework, that's the slide here that I didn't realize was coming up, of this apocalyptic view, always in purple, if you will? It's a dualism between the age of Gentiles and the age of the Messianic rule. So the old age of sin, and it doesn't mean Friday night sins, it means sin owns the world, capital S. The world is under another power than God's. But God will appear, apokalypsis. He will make manifest his will. He will awaken the martyrs and anoint all of us, the Messiah first, but all of us, as messianic people. Another word for anointing, they have many images, is he will give you his own life's breath. In Hebrew, that's ruach, his breath, his spiritus. So it's called the Holy Spiritus. It's not another God, it's just the life of God given to people. So that's what they expect. Paul's apocalyptic language, let's see, let me go back one more time. The awakening story, this is where I'm arguing that the word resurrection, which goes back to the Latin word resurrectio, or the verb resurgere, is a 5th century codification by St. Jerome, when he translated the entire Bible from Hebrew, with the use of the Greek Tanakh as well, into Latin, into common Latin. So it's called the Vulgate. That doesn't mean it's vulgar. It just means it spoke the common Latin of the time. And he took all of the Jewish metaphors for awakening and standing up, etc., and translated by this Mel Gibson word, where Yeshua gets himself up off the slab, as it were, and walks out. Resurgere is something that I do to myself. I pull myself up and walk out. What did awakening, what did that language have in Paul? Here are the three words that appear in Paul. All three of them metaphors, symbols. So Does he know, therefore, that resurrection is a symbol? The first word is egero. That means I wake somebody up. That's the verb egero. To awaken someone. Death means sleep. And awakening someone means giving them life. So they go from asleep to awake. They go from death to not the same old life, like Lazarus comes back and puts on his shirt again, sits down at table as before. No, it's the new life of the messianic kingdom. Secondly, notice that the subject of the verb is God. Yeshua didn't do it to himself. Yeshua's only a human being. Even for Paul, he's only a human being, right? But God wakes him up, thereby choosing him to be the king-elect, like president-elect, huh? To be the Messiah to come. Now he's hidden up in heaven, but the metaphor is he was asleep, dead, and God brought him into this new life. Second metaphor is, I misspelled it up there, I have anaistemi. You should drop the second A, anaistemi, to get alighted. Ana means up again. And histemi means the active verb to stand someone up on his feet again, to make somebody stand up again. So the lady falls, or the man falls on the sidewalk, and you lift him up. You've performed an act of anistemi, right? The noun is anastasis, which is still used in Greek for the standing up of Yeshua. That's the word that usually gets translated as resurrection, as if Yeshua stood himself up. No, God, as a special gift, stood him up. So those are the two words that put together come out in Latin in a word that misses their metaphoric meaning. Resurrection, resurrectio, resurgere. So the word resurrection is not the first word that was used. It's not the best word that was used. It's not the only word that was used. And yet it's been all sort of harmonized into that one term. And that one symbolic term, wake up, stand up, is now taken as a historical event instead of a symbolization of the people's belief that at the moment that he died, God woke him up, brought him to his right hand, sat him down, said, you're going to be the Messiah. An earlier phrase, Paul writes many epistles, seven epistles, and one of them is Philippians. Chapter 2 quotes a hymn, H-Y-M-N, hymn, in Greek that has an earlier word for the R event, the wake up, stand up event. How do we know it's earlier? The only way that that hymn can work is by translating it back into Aramaic. The Greek just doesn't work. It's bad Greek. But when you translate it into Aramaic, as Joseph Fitzmyer, one of the best Aramaic scholars alive today, has done, as well as Pierre Grelot, who did it some years before him, it makes absolute sense. The participles work. It has rhythm, as it doesn't in the Greek. And there, that hymn says, Yeshua submitted himself to death, even the death on the cross. Therefore, God has hyperhypsosen, has highly exalted him. Hyper is like hyper, right? Really high. And hypso means exalted. So God has lifted him up on high, maybe put him in his right hand, and given him the name Messiah, so that everybody, the angels in heaven, human beings on earth, and the devils under the earth, have to worship when they hear that name, Yeshua Mashiach. So, if Paul quotes something in Aramaic, he didn't write it, right? He writes it out in Greek. It is probably the earliest language used for what people believed God did to Yeshua at his death. Lifted him up. Now, then you could say woke him up, or stood him up on his feet after he had fallen down at the crucifixion. Right? Those are all three metaphors, apocalyptic metaphors. The apocalypse is about waking up martyrs. So we continue. So let's just go back a little bit. The three different ways of saying what God is going to do to the dead, especially the faithful dead martyrs. Now, Paul's community spreading from Jerusalem to Damascus to Antioch to southern Anatolia. Anatolia means sunrise, Anatolia, the sun comes up, Ana, up. So in Anatolia, in Turkey as we call it now, he forms these communities, first going to the synagogues and preaching this Messiah, if rejected or even if accepted, then including Gentiles, right, often getting chased out of town by Orthodox Jews who think that that's bad, forms communities in Greece, first in Philippi, where he wrote that epistle I just pointed to, then in Saloniki, Thessalonica, then in Athens, he doesn't have success, Corinth he does. And then finally plans to go to Rome. We presume that he got there, that he was martyred there, but we don't know. His last epistle is written to the Jewish community at Rome saying he's coming, the Jewish Christian community at Rome, which had already been there for some time. Now, the other communities, I say each one of these texts is a text of a group. The other communities stack up this way. This is the most probable location. The Markan community is Roman. That's why there's so much persecution, so much take up your cross. Some of them had been crucified under Nero in the 60s. And it's he who hears about the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem, right, from Rome, and writes his apocalypse, you know, the predicting it in Yeshua's mouth. Matthew's community is Palestinian. Again, it's Jewish. It may or may not have admitted Gentiles, but it was strongly Jewish. And after the destruction of the temple in 70 CE, the Sadducees, in effect, were out of a job. They were the priestly caste. The Pharisees, the populists, were the ones who then led Judaism. They formed a small group of rabbis, Pharisaic rabbis, on the coast in the city of Jamnia, or Jabne in Hebrew. And there they sat in council for about 10, 15 years, late 70s into the early 80s, maybe up till 90. And that's where Mark's community, Matthew's community, gets into trouble. They kick them out. In 80, they came up with a curse on these Jews who have this new view of the light to the Gentiles. You can take in other communities, and you can, in effect, worship or revere an unclean prophet martyr, Yeshua. That's why Matthew's gospel is so filled with anger at the Pharisees. Probably has very little to do with Yeshua, who is 50 years before him. Matthew's community is in trouble with the rabbis. That's why they are constantly going after Pharisees. You hypocrites, right? That comes from mostly Matthew. Luke, on the other hand, is Greek. He's talking to Greek Gentiles. He doesn't much care. He doesn't know much about the Jewish religion. He always has to explain things. Can't presume his audience knows much about Judaism. He's on the Gentile side. And his whole interest is in getting the Christian community, the Jewish Christian community, from Jerusalem to Rome, from its Jewish base to its Gentile base. And he writes the Acts of the Apostles as his great transportation of Peter and Paul from their Aramaic Jewish roots to Rome. That's where they both end up, and Paul especially, and gets killed. So you can see that each of these has different communities and therefore different theologies that they're developing. The North, there is no awakening. There is no what is called resurrection. Paul, who's from the South and who takes the message to the diaspora, he's not the only one, but the most famous one, is all about awakening at the end. But he proclaims it. He doesn't tell stories, not narrated. That's extremely important, as I say. It's the headlines without the story. And to read the stories back into Paul is, of course, illegitimate at worst. It's ignorant. It's just simply bad theology. By the time you get to Mark, there's a story narrated, but you never see the guy. So narrated, not seen. By the time you get to Matthew and Luke, narrated and seen a lot. By the time you get to John, narrated and really seen a lot, and does a lot of things, like telling them how to fish, cooking them breakfast, etc.
Where is John's community?
John's community is in Ephesus. Let me go back. Sorry for this. Okay. Ephesus is right where that black arrow points. It's called Kushadase today. It's a beautiful town that still has the ancient Roman city where Paul preached, where he was in prison. It has a theater, etc. And John's community is from that area. Well, let me go through all of these quickly. So, to summarize, there is no awakening in Thomas and Q. There's a proclamation of awakening in Paul. There's a narration in Mark, but no appearances. A narration in the others with many appearances and many more appearances. And they get better as you go on. The story gets better and better. More angels show up. Guards are outside the tomb in Matthew. They get everything you want in the stories. But they're not history. They are inspired religious propaganda. So we're back to that. Let me now, if I may, draw something on the board here in the last minutes that we have. Well, I have to find some board space. I hope I'm not burdening you by all the charts and so on. I myself, I mean, there are different ways that we think. There are different types of intelligence. And I always have to see pictures and maps and so on. That's what helps me to remember. I mean, I also like words and write many of them myself. But I always like to have a picture in my own mind of what's going on. Let me put one last picture up here. Paul's apocalyptic framework was in need of adjustment after his conversion in Damascus. Remember that for a true apocalyptist, everything was in the future, an imminent future to be sure, but it's in the future. Once he gets the message in Damascus and eventually in Antioch, he takes the apocalypse and redraws it. The apocalypse is not all one moment in the future. Here's the future here. It's now stretched out, not long, but there is a stretch of time between Yeshua, Paul, and the future. So, the apocalypse has already happened in the past, but in a hidden way to Yeshua. It happened at his death. There was nothing before that. Yeshua was nobody before his death. Paul knows nothing about the kingdom message. I mean, he never says anything about it. Doesn't know anything. Parables? No, it doesn't. Miracles? Not a word. Everything happens when Yeshua dies and God intervenes with the three A's. He appears to Yeshua, as it were. He shows his will to Yeshua. He awakens Yeshua, not visibly, physically, but sits him at his right hand, and he anoints Yeshua, makes him the Messiah to be. Not yet in power. Right now, Paul and the communities that he preaches to have their apocalypse, their revelation. God revealed him in me, and I'm here to preach to you so that God will reveal it in you. No doubt, read 1 Thessalonians, it's because of the community. In 1 Thessalonians, his first letter, it's all about the community. You received me. I was just taken with you. I worked. I never ate off your plates. I worked hard, etc. And you became imitators of my lifestyle. Mimetai. You became mimes, mimetics of me. And that's where you converted and turned from idols to the living God. So, apocalypse is the light goes on for these people. What about the awakening? Well, the awakening's for martyrs, right? That's going to happen at the end, or for those who've died. The awakening in Paul takes the form of a ritual. He adopts the apocalyptic baptism ritual of John. He's not the guy who invented it. It was going on, no doubt, in Jerusalem at the time. When you accept that the apocalypse has already started, is ongoing, and soon will come in its glory, then you die ahead of time. How do you die ahead of time? There's the water. You go in this way, and you go under, dude. You know, it's real dunk. It's not the little bit of drops of water on your head. That's your death. It's a ritual death to the old age. Just as Yeshua, you know, died in Paul's vision to the old age, and God opened up the new age. And then you come out of that thing, and you are, as Paul, as one of his disciples says in the Ephesians, sleeper. Awake from your sleep, and Christ will enlighten you. Sleeper, dead person, awake, and you will be enlightened. And the enlightening takes the place of the anointing, or, as Paul prefers to call it, the giving of the Spirit. How do we know we've got the Spirit? read Paul's letters, there's all sorts of people talking in weird languages, and they're spirit-filled people like Pentecostalists. So surely God's Spirit is happening right now in this community, as I saw it happen in Damascus. So you've got an interim, as it were, appearance, awakening, a ritual death resurrection, if you will, and a filling with God's messianic spirit. And then the future, soon to come. That's when the king arrives, the Messiah, right, whom God appoints at his death, sits at his right hand, will now claim his kingdom, God's kingdom for God, right? So he's going to come down, and then you will have the real apocalypse, appearance, manifestation, the kingdom, right? Paul plays down the crash and burn part. You know, he says, there's going to be travail before then, but he's not talking about fire and brimstone. The appearance or arrival of the king, that's called parousia in Greek. It means the king shows up. The awakening of all of the dead martyrs, because we have had martyrs in Jerusalem and elsewhere, right? As well as grandma, grandpa, and all those who died before the second coming. And then we will all enter the kingdom as anointed with God's Spirit. That diagram, if you will, it's Paul's, not mine, but it's there in his text, is ingenious. And it creates the program, if you will, for Christianity thereafter. A past, a present, and a future. Only the fundamentalists tend to hold to the literal future, right? What the so-called mainstream churches say, really, this is a symbol for how you should be ready at every moment, as chapter 5 of 1 Thessalonians says. Don't ask me about when, says Paul. They want to know when it's coming. Don't ask me about when. Just be sober, be awake, and be ready. Those are his words. So live a life now, which is a life of, he calls it, a labor of love among the community, as if this is the kingdom now. It'll come in its fullness, sure, but now live it so that you'll be ready for it to come at any moment. Notice what that is. That's sort of a, it's not really, but it's the beginnings of a demythologizing of this, right? It's taking this and reading it back here. So live the life of the kingdom now. You know, love one another, you know, be radically generous with each other. He's forever taking up collections for the poor in Jerusalem. But in effect, he's got the three moments, but it's really the middle moment that you're living now, he would say, and that has everything that the final moment is about. And when they ask him, well, what do I look like? What will grandma look like? He says, I don't know. I can't tell you. You'll just be filled with God's Spirit, 1 Corinthians 15. That's the genius of Paul, I think, is to take his Pharisaic apocalyptic moment and stretch it out to accommodate this new experience that he's had.
Is there any consensus as to what the preconditions are for that end, for that second coming?
There's lots of stories about that in Jewish literature of the time. The non-canonical texts of Baruch and Enoch and so on, and they are repeated likewise in Mark chapter 13, where Yeshua has an apocalyptic discourse put in his mouth, where he says, look out for this, look out for that. There will be false messiahs. That's one sign. We call them antichrist. You know, they're against the real Messiah who will appear. There will be wars and rumors of wars. There will be all sorts of disasters
and
tragedies.
There are certain things, signs that will indicate that it's imminent.
And guess who knows who those signs are? Our evangelical brothers and sisters who read the signs, right?
Where's the red hype heifer coming?
That's actually within the Jewish tradition. And there was a great article about that in the New Yorker a while back because they found a red heifer in Israel, you know. And I don't know exactly where that comes from. It's more in Tanakh.
It's not part of this.
It's not part of this. But there are, you know, this is the time of tribulation, which is compared to a woman in birth pangs. It's terrible pain. And the birth is going to be pain, but the outcome will be the messianic kingdom. So there's lots of metaphors for that. It's called the wrath to come. Paul compares it to a woman in childbirth, and that's a trope, that is to say, a form of speech that's available in Jewish literature all over the place. Persecutions is obviously a part of it because, again, as in Daniel's time, the persecution by Antiochus was a sign that God was going to awaken the dead soon, you know, and reclaim his temple. So there's lots of that language.
The other great religions of, you know, find the same inconsistencies in historical fact and contemporary beliefs and writings?
My guess is yes, but I'm thinking more of the three major monotheistic religions of the book, as they're sometimes called, the Abrahamic religions. Karen Armstrong has just published yet a new book, a second Life of Muhammad. It's called A Prophet for Our Times. I heard her on the radio today. She's a friend, and she's really a brilliant writer. And she is very positive about the Prophet Muhammad and how his teachings get maybe changed by people who follow after. But even the historical story about Muhammad is up for grabs. But that's something that is, how shall I put it, has yet to reach academic acceptability. You question that, you might be in a little bit of trouble. The Christians had a long time getting to that, the Catholics being the last and, you know, to accept that there was this historical change. Judaism itself, as we pointed out earlier, through its own archaeologists, is beginning to call into question. There's a course being taught, by the way, during the regular semester next quarter, the winter quarter, called King David by Professor Levine, who's an expert on Tanakh. You know, and David is probably not all that the books of Samuel and Kings tell us. So there's always been that sort of issue, because what counts more is the religious interpretation, the historicness, not the history, not the historiography, but the meaning of it now. I hope he does. I love Gregory Peck. Can't have everything. It's 9 o'clock, so we'll call it now, and see you next week for our last meeting. Thank you.
The preceding program was brought to you by Stanford on iTunes U and is copyrighted by the Board of Trustees of the Leland Stanford Junior University. Please visit us at itunes.stanford.edu.